Welcome to the Resilient Recruiter Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Whitby. We're recording in person in Atlanta, Georgia, and I'm excited to be joined by Brock Boyd.
I work by far the hardest in the best of times and the next hardest in the normal times. And I like to work the least hard in the worst of times. You know, the cost of opportunity when times are at their worst, if you're not working as hard, you're leaving a lot less on the table. If times are really good and you're not working hard, you're leaving a lot on the table.
Brock is the president and founder of Career Management Inc., CMI, based in Virginia. Brock's been in the recruiting game since 1998, and he specializes in executive search for sales and sales management roles within the technology industry.
I started this company when I was 23. I couldn't believe it happened. Then it was going well. Then it was hiring people. And this whole time, I'm like, man, I wonder when this whole thing's going to end. I hope not anytime soon, right? But you never know.
Brock is a member of the Pinnacle Society, which is a group of some of the top performing recruiters in the United States. And I am really excited to have you here, Brock. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
All right. So I think we've met, is this our third time?
I believe so.
Yeah.
First at a meeting. Yeah. Uh-huh. And then Zoom.
Oh, yeah, Zoom. But okay. We met last year. Were you at Pinnacle last year?
I don't recall.
Okay.
If we were at an overlapping
Savannah.
Pinnacle.
Did you go to Savannah?
I did not.
No, okay. All right. So this is the third time.
Yep.
And the second in person. Great.
That's right.
So you've flown in from DC today.
Virginia, yep.
And so I appreciate you coming straight here. You've not even been to the hotel or anything yet.
That's right.
I'm grateful. So, Brock, how did you get into recruiting?
So, I don't know if this will be a long, boring story, but it is a long story. So I'll try to shrink it down for you. So when I was in college, I really had no idea what I wanted to do. I had an inkling that I wanted to be in sales. Mm-hmm. I knew a guy, this guy's my savior, who... He knew that I had a car and he didn't have a car, and that guy kind of had his stuff together and I less so at that time. He called me once to say, are you going up to the job fair at George Mason University? I didn't even know what that was. And I definitely didn't know that there was going to be a job fair anytime soon. So I said, I don't know. I guess, how does that work? And he said, well, if you drive me there, I'll help you put together a resume and so on. So long story short, the two of us go up to this job fair. I had no idea what to expect. It was mostly sales-related positions, and there was a staffing firm there, and that was Aerotech, which now most people know as Allegis Group.
Yep.
Multi-billion, large private staffing firm. And so the rest is history. I interviewed on the spot and then did a couple more interviews and went to work there. And I worked there for about a year and then left there to start up CMI.
Fantastic. So talk me through, you're in this career fair. Mm-hmm. There's lots of companies exhibiting to try and recruit grads, presumably, to come and join their firm. And why did you gravitate to Aerotech and like out of everything else in the room?
So they had a group of young people that looked, kind of similar in age to me. And
yeah.
They looked kind of like, I don't know how to say it, but young and fun and whatever. It just like that booth had more energy than the other booths did.
Yeah, it makes sense.
But when it said staffing, I had no clue what that was. So anyhow, I talked to them for a while and I continued to be enthusiastic about working more so with those people than doing the job of recruiting.
Okay, got it.
And so then, multi-step interview process, I get hired. I was in a training class of 65 people.
Wow.
And I remember in that training class of 65, one of the first things that the trainer said was, raise your hand if you don't know what this job is or what staffing is. And almost everyone raised their hand, including me.
That's awesome. Wow. So you, even after you got the job, you weren't 100% sure what it is you were supposed to be doing.
Correct.
Wow. That's fantastic. All right. So, and then, but you launched your own firm after only what, two years?
11 months.
Wow. You are super confident. Holy cow. Like 11 months in, going from, I don't even know what staffing is, to I'm going to launch my own recruiting firm. What happened in those 11 months that made you so confident?
So I had a friend and I really, I owe a debt to a bunch of people for the early days of CMI. But while I'm sitting there recruiting, and it was telecom technicians, and I wasn't doing the sales part of staffing. This was contract staffing, so they split the role into their sellers and there's recruiters, and I was a recruiter. And so I was recruiting telecom technicians, and I can only, you know, tell you halfway what those people do at this point in time, right? But anyhow, I had a friend who calls me and says, hey, my company's looking for salespeople. Does your company play salespeople? And we didn't. And I said, no. And he said, well, we're looking for salespeople and we offer referral fees if anybody refers to somebody that we hire in sales. And you know, my first thought was like, what he was saying was not congruent with my understanding of how staffing worked, mostly because I had never seen a perm deal happen in my life.
Right.
And so I was like, his name was Eric. I was like, Eric, I don't think you know how this works. So, you know, it's different than what you think. And he was like, well, look, we hire entry-level people for sales jobs. Okay. And if they hire someone you send over, they will pay you a referral fee, you know, if you get signed up with them, and I will make that happen. So I was like, all right, well, you know, sounds like it could be pretty simple and straightforward. So so long story short, I ended up doing that, sending a handful of just my friends to interview at this place. They hired one of them, and I was going to get paid a fee and a referral fee. And it was literally within a week of that, another friend of mine said, hey, I heard that you referred some people over to Eric's company. My mom is the head of HR for a company that looks for the same kind of people. You should contact my mom and see if they're still looking right now. And I was like, okay, yeah, sounds like a good idea. Contact his mom. And it was literally within a pretty short time frame, the same thing happened again. I sent her partly some of the same group of people, and they hired one of them. And at that point, I thought to myself, wow, I wonder if there's like a whole bunch of companies out there that need to hire salespeople. It sounds hilarious to say out loud right now. And if so, maybe that could be my full-time job. That was kind of how the mental steps went. So it was definitely not a lot of strategy, planning, not even sure you could call it confidence at that point, right? I was just 23 years old. So it was a little bit of like, you know, I don't have a lot of responsibility and what have you. So I decided if I can call a bunch of companies and get one more customer, if that's what I could call the first two, then I would leave and do this full time. And that was the scenario for me. So we had one day a week where you could leave early, 4 p.m. And I rushed over to a friend's place who lived close by, and I just cold called a bunch of companies, and one of them said yes, and that was it. So I made my decision from there, and I quit my job shortly afterwards and set up shop, like left on a Friday, started on a Monday, and that's the story.
Two questions. First of all, you were only doing you were doing the candidate delivery side of the business at Aerotech.
Correct.
But then you thought, I know, I'm going to cold call a bunch of companies. Mm. That instinct, like, had you ever made cold calls before or?
Again, to not make what should be a short story long. Basically, yes, I did work for a little while as a promoter in college for nightclubs or a nightclub.
Okay.
And one of the things that the boss had us do was he would give us lists of names and phone numbers of people who would sign up for a mailing list. And we had to call them and say, hey, we're having this special party on Thursday night. Okay. You need to come down or whatever.
Yeah.
So I had called strangers before, mm-hmm. but not a whole lot.
Yeah. And also that's B2C rather than B2B.
Right.
And which I don't know if it's harder necessarily or easier, but that's cool. So you—
B2B is much harder.
Yeah. Yeah. So you made a bunch of calls. You got someone who said, yeah, we need salespeople. Mm-hmm. And you thought, well, all right. But what was it that was more attractive about that than what you were already doing?
So I would say that what I was already doing was inside of a very established company that was over $1 billion in revenue already. And they did an incredibly good job in terms of internal controls and training. Yeah. The difficulty for me was I enjoyed attempting at least to be creative.
Mm-hmm.
And I was told in that organization, stop trying to figure out a different way to do it and just put the caps on the bottles and keep putting the caps on the bottles.
Okay.
Right? Stop trying to reinvent this. Yeah. And that was difficult to stomach after a period of time.
Yeah. And which makes total sense from the Allegia's point of view, right? Mm-hmm. They've got a formula that works, just work the formula.
Yep.
But if you're entrepreneurial, creative, then that's going to get tired pretty fast, right?
That so, is right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay, fantastic. So you dive in, you haven't, you're completely self-taught then. Like you obviously had the Allegia's training, which is great, but this is a different thing. And how did you figure it out?
Yeah, well, so one more fun part of that is I told you I left on a Friday and started on a Monday. Well, started meant in my mind, I've got to get as many customers as possible, as fast as possible.
Okay.
Maybe I have three, but I kind of had this instinctual feeling that like, you know, any of those three could go away at any
it's
minute.
A good instinct.
So I need as many customers as possible, right?
Yeah.
So I spent the whole weekend making this giant list of companies that I was going to call. I think it was only 40 that I called on the first day, Monday. All 40 of them were no. One of them gave me a long speech, and I'll never forget. She said, "Recruiting? Haven't you heard of the internet? Oh, honey, this recruiting thing's not going to exist in 2 years. Like, you really need to rethink whether or not you want to do this." And I was kind of like, oh, I just left this, you know, very comfortable job where I was virtually guaranteed to be promoted sometime soon. So, you know, it shook me a little bit that first day, but, you know, a few more days. Yeah. And like you said, self-taught. So, I mean, it's like, if you can think of the mistakes that a person can make in this industry, I was making all of them. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember it was probably shortly after that first day that I remember getting a head of sales on the phone and saying, "How much do you pay other recruiters?" And whatever number he gave me, I was like, "Well, I'll do it for," and I reduced that by 10%. It was basically like, "I'll do it for less. Just please work with me," right? So yeah, very, you know, trials and tribulations.
Okay. So then at what point did you hone in on software sales?
In the very beginning, I would say for the first 9 to 12 months, it was sales of any kind. And because of where I came from, I did have an inclination to stay within a niche because I had seen at Allegia's Group, everybody was, you know, very, very tight niches, right? So that just was kind of what I had seen around me. So I decided it was going to be sales. And I pretty quickly decided it was going to be business to business sales, like the fee structure and some other things weren't going to really work out in a non-B2B sale.
Because in B2C sales industries, typically there's no basic salary. Right. Like if you think of insurance or things like that,
that's right.
You know, then how do you, it's harder to calculate your fee and it's also harder to get candidates to do it.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah, yep. I get it.
So, so really the software sales, I really kind of, you know, fell into by accident. The first time that I got a technology-related client, it was actually a technology. Well, they didn't call themselves that. They called themselves an IT consulting firm, but it was really like an IT staffing firm. Mm-hmm. And I placed a couple people there. And I think that company referred me to my first software company client. And it did feel different. It felt kind of easier to do. The fee was bigger. The way that the interview prep and, you know, kind of overseeing the process was different in a way that I found more satisfying.
Yes.
And so, you know, we kind of were still taking what we could get for a period of time, but we were looking for software sales.
It's so interesting, Brock, because we're similar age. And so this would be what, in 99 or something?
98.
Yep. So I was also a sales recruiter in 98, and I was just, I placed any type of salesperson and then quickly realized over time, well, A, that's hard to make that work, but B, I realized that, so if I place someone selling photocopiers, their basic salary was like 15,000 pounds at the time. If I place a software salesperson, their salary was like 60,000 pounds. Four times as much. And I was like, it's the same job. Why is that guy getting paid? Well, because the value of what they're selling is so much higher, right? But so it took me much longer to come to this realization, I think, than you do. I did all kinds of software or all kinds of sales roles for quite a while before I figured out, hey, I need to specialize in software. But you have stuck at it much longer than I did. So we're now going on, I guess, 25 years.
26
you've been doing
and
this.
A half years.
Wow.
April of 98. Thank you.
That is an achievement, Brock. That is incredible. So we're not in a 1 hour podcast, we're not going to cover 25 years like in any depth, but I wonder if you might share what has been like the highest high and what's been the lowest low.
That's actually relatively easy. The highest highs in my view, without having statistical data to back this up, would because I'm going more by what it felt like in each of these times, would be a tie probably between 99 and 2000.
Okay.
And then again in 2021 and 2022.
Really? Wow.
Or the first 9 months of 2022.
Okay.
Yeah.
So almost bookending the beginning of your career and then recent memory.
That's right. So those felt like the highs.
Why? And, why do you say that?
You know, I think it was just volume of hiring in the marketplace that we were dealing in.
Okay.
Right. In both cases, we're just through the roof. And take 2006, 2005, 6, and 7, which were great job markets, right? By any and all standards. And same thing with 2017, 18, 19. They were great. They just weren't the incredible level of hiring that we saw in our fields in 99 and 2000. .com, right? So tons of money getting thrown to just stand companies up from scratch.
Exactly. And most of them were ridiculous ideas that had no monetization, right? It's, I remember one company, so it, I'm not going to name it, but they did corporate events. Mm-hmm. It was actually a valid business model, unlike some of the ones that like advertised in the Super Bowl and spent millions of, you know, VC money on stuff like that. But so this company organized corporate events, but it was an e-commerce model. So you booked stuff through their website, basically. So if you have employees, you want to organize like a day at the, you know, quad biking or whatever, right? Or golf or spa day or whatever, you could book it through this website. And I placed about 5 salespeople with this company and they went bust. I didn't get a penny of that money because 2000... This was 99, 2000, and the bubble burst and, you know, the VC money dried up. They didn't get their next funding round and they went out of business and I was out of luck.
Mm-hmm. I know exactly what you're talking about. It happened to us, you know, times X. I don't know the number of clients that we had that that happened with, but it was quite a few. But so you're talking about the same time frame where the worst moment that I can remember was, you know, for us, the market in 2001 was deteriorating, but kind of slowly and steadily, you know, and 9/11 accelerated that some, but in my head, 2002 was the worst for those of us that were, that our customers were technology companies, and which for a period of time meant a lot of them were these dot-coms like what you're talking about. I mean, we had one client that like, you know, they had raised an insane amount of money for a website where you would plug in things like, you know, birthdays and stuff, and they would send you email reminders.
Right.
That was the entire model. Like, and how's that going
where's
to
the
make
competitive advantage? Like that can be copied so easily.
And where's the big money coming from, you know,
who's, exactly.
big revenue coming from? Like who's going to be paying for, you know, so anyhow, so we had a handful, just like you just described, of clients go out of business in 2001, more so than 2000. Okay. 2000, you know, you could feel rumbles, but 2001 was really when companies started folding. And in 2002, when we had a bunch of our clients had gone out of business, far less hiring in the technology segment as a whole. And at the very worst point in time, we had a company that we had put a contractor out, which again, we weren't in that business, but we had a contractor who we had been paying money. They filed Chapter 11. They owed us $63,000. We were a small company. Yeah. They owed us $63,000 when they filed Chapter 11. And I thought, oh, we're going to get that money. It's just a matter of when. And the fast forward, we got $110 out of that $63,000. But so a few months after that, I got a notification in the mail saying, you were paid by this company within 90 days of them filing for bankruptcy. That's called a preferential payment. You owe that $36,000 back. This was at the absolute worst possible time that I could have gotten that. So, and then, you know, in the end, with the help of attorneys, we, you know, discovered that no, in fact, and there's some really wonky rule there that they had actually done more than that $36,000 worth of business with us between the time that they paid it and when they filed Chapter 11. And so we ended up, had to get attorneys involved, but we ended up not having to pay that. But that's the lowest moment that I can recall in the business's history right there.
Wow. Yeah. That must've been super stressful. And did you have family yet or were you still?
No. So I would have been 28 years old ish and no family.
Okay.
I had kept my bills relatively low. So there wasn't the personal financial concern there, but there was definitely the business financial concern.
Yeah, absolutely. So the highs you're describing are when there's a lot of demand in the market, but that's out of your control, right? Mm-hmm. We can't control the market. So let me rephrase the question more aligned with, what do you feel you're most proud of having accomplished?
I guess I would say getting through the toughest of times, still having a business intact, right?
Yep.
Including that 2002 timeframe that we were just talking about. That's probably what I am most proud of, because then when I look at the times where we had incredibly positive numbers from a revenue and profitability standpoint and the earnings of the people on our team, that is, you know, something that I take a lot of pride in and get really enthusiastic about as well. The highs of how that felt are probably, you know, not as strong of a feeling as how, brutal it felt during those toughest of times. And the other thing is, I guess I would say, I don't know that I feel proud when we've crushed it, because deep down I'm working, I'm always trying new things. I'm doing the best I can to, help the company move forward and stay modernized and all that sort of thing. But I really believe that such a large chunk of it has to do with that demand that's out of your control. So that's why I'm less proud of the highest high points and more proud of making it through those lowest low points.
It makes sense. My friend Greg Savage says, like, when you're riding high and everything's going, you're going great, don't get too full of yourself, right? Like, just take it down a notch, because of course some of it was you and some of it was the market. But don't think you've made it and you know everything about everything to do with recruiting. Likewise, don't beat yourself up too bad when things go to shit and like you're having a tough time, because again, there's probably learnings, there's things you could have improved, but also there's the market as well, which is outside your control. So try and stay on an even keel, you know, don't get too excited, don't get too, you know, down in the dumps, just keep going. That's like the important thing, keep going. You've embodied that, I guess.
I agree with that philosophy 100%. And I think for me, I like to think that I've kept a somewhat even keel as much as a person I can, I guess, during the kind of highs and lows. But from a work ethic standpoint, I've said to many people, and I have yet to hear someone say, yeah, I'm on the same page. So I think that this philosophy is not uber popular but I personally I work by far the hardest in the best of times. And the next hardest in the normal times.
Right.
And I like to work the least hard in the worst of times because of my perception about opportunity, the cost of opportunity. And so basically, the cost of opportunity when times are at their worst, if you're not working as hard, you're leaving a lot less on the table. If times are really good and you're not working hard, you're leaving a lot on the table. And also, as something that, I think it was in San Diego when I spoke about personal finances and investments. I think one of the keys to that is being able to earn as much as possible during the timeframes when things are good and kind of stock that away, either to make investments or make investments right away, so that you have less to worry about during those fluctuations.
You know, I'm you've read my mind, Brock, because that's what I want to talk to you about today. I loved your presentation in San Diego, by the way, at the Pinnacle conference there. And this is a topic, personal finance for recruiters, that I don't know what, I've never heard anyone else talk about that. Actually, there's one lady, I don't know if you have heard this lady, Dan Dan. She runs a podcast and she has a rec-to-rec business. So, and she became a self-made millionaire in her 20s from, you know, being frugal and investing basically while she was recruiting. So she made as much money as she could while recruiting. And then she was investing in property and stocks and everything else. But what I see is recruiters spend at or in excess of their income. And like, because I used to go to recruiting companies and train their teams and their managers and stuff. And I would drive into the parking lot and my family, like people carrier made by Volkswagen. Volkswagen's a good car, like it's a quality car, but it's not a luxury car. And I'd pull into my and the Volkswagen and the parking lot's full of BMWs, Mercedes, Lexus, Jaguars. And this is not the owners. This is like the staff. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, man, like what, how, why would you, I don't know. It just didn't make sense to me. They look rich, but are they, you know, how much of that are they saving? So could you share a little bit about your philosophy when it comes to personal finance and how you have set things up to ensure that you and your family have that security regardless of what the market is doing?
Yeah, and I'm a visual person, so I'm going to do the best I can without a whiteboard. But I would say that for me, that the kind of beginning part of my philosophy would be wherever your earnings are, the farther below that your spending is, or your lifestyle is, or whatever you want to call that, the faster you're going to reach financial freedom. And to me, financial freedom means different things for different people. But, you know, it mostly, to most of us, I think it means A, you don't really have to worry about money. And B, you could legitimately choose to stop working and just live as a retiree for the rest of your life, which, you know, has happened for me, but I don't have any intention to stop working anytime soon. But it is a nonetheless very, very desirable feeling or, you know, place to be. And so again, I guess I would say I would try to encapsulate it at its most basic level. The further below your earnings, your lifestyle and spending are, the faster you're going to get to that point. And the closer they are, or God forbid they're overlapped in the wrong direction, then the further away that is and the longer that you have to work. And what tends to happen too during that time, if they're, you know, really, really close or synced up, or, you know, again, they're spending more than they make, is that their lifestyle creep is, it's eternal. It keeps going. So they continually increase their spending over time. And, you know, it's a natural thing to do that. So it's kind of like if you can just imagine that, you know, there's, you know, two stones, two boulders, and, you know, the big one is your savings and the small one is your spending. The longer you can keep the big one bigger than the small one, the better. And you're going to have in recruiting, you're going to have 1 or 2 years out of 10 where it's frankly not possible, right? If you know, if you have recession years where, or you have whatever it is, whether it's a recession or not, just for one reason or another, you have your income just drop precipitously for a year. And
there could be lots of reasons for that, by the way, sort of interrupt your flow, like recession, personal situation, aging parents, you know, if it's a woman wants to start a family, I mean, lots of reasons why your earnings would be lower in any given year.
Mm-hmm. And so, so it's not totally possible all the time, but it's critical that you are handling it in this way in the years that it is possible.
Okay. And so do you have a formula that you apply to your, for yourself of how much you want to be able to invest or?
You know, I wish the answer was yes. The reality is that it started for me really early on because I got really lucky when I started, right? So if you think of starting in April of 1998, the wind was really at my back.
Yeah.
So I had, I had 3 years of, or you could say at least 2.5 years, if not three, of just really strong market conditions. And during that time, you know, and I was very young, and during that time, I kept my expenses incredibly low. So when I started the company, I was in my parents', living in my parents' house for a very short period of time. Moved in with some friends, lived in the basement, didn't even have a room. I just had a corner of the basement, the bed and a dresser, and that's it, right?
Oh, you're like a monk, bro.
But yeah, only, you know, again, this was for a period of time, right? And then the next place that I moved into was, you know, with a couple friends from college, but now I actually had my own bedroom with a door that would shut and everything. And that was CMI's first office, actually. There was a period of time where two guys were coming to that bedroom every day with full suits and ties on, right? And half the time they might knock on the door and I might still be sleeping because I was working so late the night before. So anyhow, that was still very inexpensive. And this is when times were, you know, things were really, really good. And so, you know, that then, you know, we hit shortly after that, we hit a recession, 2001, 2002. Yeah. So I didn't really step on the gas pedal of...
As an aside, a lot of people don't kind of count that as a recession, but there was definitely, I mean, it wasn't like the Great Recession or anything, but after 9/11, that was a huge shock to every, in so many ways, of course, but it was a shock to the economy. People didn't want to fly. They didn't want to travel by air. It disrupted, like, Wall Street closed for a couple of days, I think. And, you know, that was, there was repercussions from that, which definitely affected recruiting for sure.
One thing that's interesting is when you look at the different segments within recruiting, so industry focus, right? So people who place accountants versus place environmental people versus place salespeople versus place tech people and on and on and on, healthcare, what have you, that oftentimes their answers for how a market, you know, how the market conditions were are quite different.
Yes.
Right? And that's true today.
Saying that now, yeah, absolutely.
And so I feel like for the most part, it's probably in large part who your customers were,
mm-hmm.
more so probably even than the type of skill set that you're placing. Although, of course, you could have, you know, skill demand higher while one other is much lower, of course. But, you know, our companies were then and are now small tech companies.
Yeah.
And so when I talk to people today, the ones who, you know, seem to be having the most struggles today relative to 2021 and 22, like we are, it tends to be people who either place tech salespeople in small tech companies or people who place tech people, software developers and so on, in small tech companies. Yeah. And then the rest, it seem, are down to my knowledge, but they're down to much more manageable degrees, mm-hmm. than you know, some of what the rest of us have seen. So when I look back at 2001 and 2002, that was a time when I did not operate under the philosophy that I explained. You know, times were brutal and I was working really hard, banging my head against the wall. And
but you had, at that point, you have to.
Yeah.
Right? Because so I started my business September 1st, 2001. Okay. And
tough time.
Yeah.
10 and, days. Later, yeah.
But what can you do? Like, mm-hmm. you've got to hustle and grind and just make it work, right? Because what's the alternative? You can't just give up,
right?
So we took a sort of massive tangent here. I want to circle back to your. I apologize. That was me interrupting your personal finance and investing framework.
Oh yeah, and we were talking about 2001 too, because I was saying that was such a tough time for us.
Yeah.
So because that was a tough time for us, I didn't really step on the gas pedal of spending. So I still had spending really low. And so it really wasn't until several years later that I allowed myself to, let lifestyle creep happen to me,
mm-hmm.
the same way that it does to a lot of people. Yeah. And so again, that, you know, the big boulder was far out in front of the smaller boulder, and the smaller boulder was still smaller. A lot smaller for that reason. And so I had a lot of years of saving a lot.
Mm.
And, you know, quite frankly, sometimes making aggressive investments, it did not work out that well at that time. But still, the mindset and philosophy were the same. And so, And so that for me was, you know, critical. If I had ever decided, well, I'm only ever going to make more or significantly more income than I do right now, I would have made a whole different set of, you know, decisions, and I would not be in, you know, anything like the place that I'm in right now. I'd be in a much more probably nervous place all the time.
So what you're saying is you assumed that your earnings were going to be relatively the same rather than assume, because I think this is, I've told myself this lie many times, is justifying spending because I'll make more money, you know, next month, next quarter, next year. I'll be able to, it'll be fine. And be over optimistic about the future and what your future earnings will be. I've definitely made that mistake. So I like you're taking a much more conservative approach to this, Brock, which is very disciplined. Where does that come from?
Okay, so that comes from, the answer to that is an unfortunate one. So what I'll say is that the optimism that you're describing that you've had is what is good in 90% of life and life decisions and so on. It's like optimism about the future, right? And so, you know, it's funny, I was just writing a note to my son about all the benefits of optimism and that there's only like a couple of rare cases where optimism can work against you. And in my opinion, one of them is in the investments world.
Right.
You know, if you're highly optimistic about what every investment can do or will do, you can make some, you know, dicey decisions that way. That and things where there's a very real risk of safety, then yes. I think that being highly optimistic could be not necessary. But all the rest of the time in life, it pays and is beneficial to be optimistic. So having said that, for me, it was a healthy dose of pessimism. I started this company, I was 23. I couldn't believe it happened. Then it was going well. Then it was hiring people. And this whole time I'm like, man, I wonder when this whole thing's gonna end. I hope not anytime soon, right? But you never know. So in my head, it was like, this whole, you know, roller coaster could end at any period of time. So I need to have as much as possible set aside for if right. or when that ever happens.
Yeah, it's a little bit almost like, I can't believe how well this is working. This can't continue forever. Like, what? Yeah, right. I better just make the most of it because it's definitely not, it's going to come to an end sometime. So that's funny.
And each time that that I see like a high point in, you know, which usually are combined market conditions with, you know, my own performance and the performance of this, you know, awesome team of people that I work with, yeah. That leads to a high personal income. And then some sort of, you know, downward trend happens. Every time I've thought, well, that'll be the last time that I ever make that kind of income. And then, you know,
it's funny.
It's usually several years later before, you know, at a minimum, before I do get back to that, if it was because of a recession. But I've thought that more than once, more than twice.
So Brock, the thing you have on your side is time. Time is a huge factor in compounding, right? So you relatively at a young age, you decided that this was the way you were gonna work. What advice do you have for people who are not starting when they're 23 but have realized I actually can't afford to retire for I probably can never retire, right? I need to change that. What would you say to that person?
So I would say the same thing that I would say to someone who's, you know, much earlier in their career and has, you know, as you said, going to have the benefit of compounding over time, which is that there's kind of, you know, three things that they need to think about. Earnings from work, right? Or, you know, earnings from your business or your job or whatever. So earnings from work, earnings from investments, and lifestyle, or let's say expenses, whatever you want to call that. So those are the three variables that you need to be looking at and thinking about. And the more that you can increase earnings from work and earnings from investments, you know, then the more you can tuck away if your lifestyle stays below that, and the further below it is, the faster you're tucking away more, right? And so, you know, of course, part of the challenge that I think you're getting to is that in order to have a large amount that can therefore earn a lot from the investments, you needed to have earned much more than you were spending over a period of time, most likely. But it's never too late. Just like it's never too late to start eating healthy and having a healthy lifestyle, it's never too late. It's just going to have a greater impact in a shorter time frame. I shouldn't say that. It's going to have a greater impact over a longer time frame, probably, than, you know, for the person who started earlier on.
Right, exactly. But okay, that makes a lot of sense. Never too late. Any other, like, you've obviously spent a dedicated, I know that you've studied this, like, you've really intensely, you're interested in, you know, personal financial freedom, and you've studied it, you've read up on it, you've experimented with your own money, trying different things. What can you sort of distill, like, what's been the biggest lessons apart from what you've already shared?
Yeah. And I don't know if this can answer what you're asking, but you just triggered a thought in my head that, you know, stay away from the extremes, right? So there's the extreme of, if people really hear the kind of, you know, earnings from work, they barely hear it. Lifestyle or expenses, they barely hear it. But earnings from investments, they really hear that. And, you know, there's a group of investments that you can call alternative or exotic investments or private investments. And I make a lot of these type investments. They're very, very risky. Yeah. And you're hoping that they get you a substantially larger return, but they can go to zero. So you can lose your entire principal. Yeah. And so what I would say about that whole asset class, right? If you think about, like, checking accounts, saving accounts, CDs, mm-hmm. safe, you know, treasury bills, whatever, safest stuff out there, right?
Can I ask about that though? So CDs, cash deposits, mm-hmm. but with inflation, then that money is actually shrinking sitting there. But are you just saying you still need to have that safety net, even though it's the value of that asset is decreasing in an inflationary?
Part of what I was saying is that that's an extreme, right? So that's an extreme on one side of the extremely safe side, where you can be, there is such a thing as being too safe, right? Yeah. But I'd way rather be on that extreme than the other one, but you can be too safe. But, you know, these days CDs and bank accounts will pay 4%+, some of them 5%+. So you can actually do quite well in some of these things relative to their risk,
okay.
which is zero if they're FDIC insured. So that's incredible. You can get 5% with FDIC insured money. That's just insane. That means it's literally cannot go away unless, you know, the United States of America ceases to exist as we know it, right? So then you move to the next category, which is stocks and bonds. I'm not that big into bonds. Some people are. That's great. So I'm not going to talk about it because I'm not into it. But stocks is still, if you've got a time horizon that's long enough, yeah. then stocks, if you're buying an index fund or if you're buying an ETF that covers a broad index like the S&P 500, then that is also still very safe. It just obviously can fluctuate quite a bit in the short term. But if your time horizon is long enough, that's still very safe. And then on the alternative side, you can certainly push up returns higher than in either of those two, but you're taking substantially greater risk. So I would say to people, be careful about this, you know, alternative investments category. I'm not saying don't do it. Part of how I got where I am is investing with a friend who is he's a developer. So he'll buy houses. He'll either tear them down and build something new and then sell it, mm-hmm. or he'll just do a very, very large renovation on a property and then sell it. And what I was doing was investing those projects. It's essentially the equivalent of buying stock in the outcome of that project, right? Mm-hmm. So you're going to have a 9 to 18 month wait or something like that. It depends. It could be a lot shorter depending on what the amount of work is somebody's going to do. But that was a major contributor to where I am today for a period of some years when a friend of mine was doing that full time and there was a lot of opportunity and he needed capital and I was very happy to be involved with this and so on. So these things can be very much needle movers. You just have to be careful. Mm. And if it's not someone you've known for 10 plus years who's telling you about the opportunity, you just need to be very skeptical and look at a lot of them. And if you encounter someone who will act as even remotely any kind of mentor or strip that word out and call them whatever you want, who's been investing in this asset class for 10 plus years, mm-hmm. then it'd be a very good idea to throw a sidecar onto that person and try to invest where they're investing. Mm-hmm. But, you know, start out with small dollars. Just remember that this asset class can lose, right? Yeah. The savings and CDs, they can't go away again unless the U.S. government goes away. Stocks, if you buy a, you know, something that's trailing the S&P 500 or tracking the S&P 500, it can't go to zero because all the worst performing companies are replaced with the best know, performing companies. So over time, you'll be fine there. Over here, you can lose everything you put in. So be careful as a percentage of your total, you know, net worth or assets that you're putting into any individual deal. That's a big one, by the way. Mm-hmm. That is another thing. I don't mean to go off
no, this
on
is good.
Several
I'm,
tangents
I'm,
here.
I'm soaking this up. So before you get to that, you're about to talk about percentage of your capital that you invest in any one deal, but what about asset allocation overall? And obviously everyone has their own formula based on age and risk appetite, but like, what's your philosophy there?
I don't, so first of all, I'll just say that I don't use a financial advisor. If I did, they would have probably already forced me to have a much more formulaic with, you know, numbers behind it that were very exact. Yeah. And so instead, mine is a little bit more of kind of a loose construction of what I feel makes sense for me. Okay. You know, and there's a lot about like a stock and bond portfolio and what percentage it should be based on your age. I am not very inclined to go heavy into bonds anytime soon. Yeah. So for me, I'm much more interested in riskier assets, which would be, you know, in the stock market, although I don't buy a lot of individual stocks. I'm buying, you know, ETFs or index funds that track.
Like a Vanguard sort of index fund type thing.
Exactly. Yep. Whether it's a Vanguard or SPY that tracks the S&P 500 and the ones that track, you know, the Russell 2000, the NASDAQ, you know, an international one. And then there are bond funds out there. Now, when I hit a certain age, and I can't say this with confidence, but let's say around 65, I'm probably going to suddenly become a lot more interested in bonds than I am today. But so I am comfortable with, now I keep a somewhat substantial amount, both in general and as a percentage of my total assets in those really, really safe things. Because I'm always going to be of the mindset of waiting for some time when assets go on sale.
Well, you just described your inclination is skeptical, pessimistic when it comes to finance. So that makes sense.
And therefore, I want to be ready when assets go on sale to purchase a bunch of them on sale.
Okay, right? Brilliant. Yeah.
And I did that in 2002 and I did that in 2009. I still did it skeptically at lower levels than I wish I had kind of amped up the amount of that I did, but I always felt like you never really know where the bottom is. So I'm going to be, you know, cautious as I do this. But so I would say though, you know, so I answered your question to say, I don't have a real answer.
Okay.
But my number one thing is no matter how great you think something is, I've heard people say things like, this is working out so well that I'm going to put all of my assets into this. Or, you know, 80 or 90% of my funds into this or my entire 401k. That is terrifying when I hear that. And usually when people say that, they're not asking my advice. They're just informing me. And it's a terrifying thing for me to hear.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Because that's, you know, nobody knew that Bernie Madoff was Bernie Madoff until, you know, the tide went out and he was naked, right? Yeah. So you just don't know. So the easiest way to protect against fraud or gross mismanagement is to be diversified.
Well, any one thing, even if it's well run or well managed, can be destroyed. You know, so we're on the same page there. So you were then going to say you would never invest overly in one thing. Could you elaborate on that?
Roughly 10%.
Okay.
In my mind, if that one thing that I did have 10% of my total asset value dollars were placed into, and that were to go to zero, you still have 90%.
You can recover.
Life is not over. Yeah.
Okay.
But if you had 50%+, very, very different story. That's where you hear some, you know, horrifying stories of what happens after that.
Okay. So this is, I love this kind of information, Brock, and I don't hear it from in the recruiting industry typically. So I've read books about it, but it's really awesome to hear your approach, because that set you up. So the market right now in tech, a lot of people, not everyone, but a lot of the people I'm speaking to are saying 2023 was their worst year ever. And they, even if they're a big biller or they've been doing this for 20 years or whatever, what's been your experience?
It wasn't my worst year ever or even close to that, but okay. But it was, quite frankly, it was half of 2022.
Okay, wow.
And so, and that was, you know, we had the same number of people. So it was half on a personal basis, a little bit better than half, slightly better than half. On a personal basis, you know, on a, you know, our business as a whole, mm-hmm. chopped in half. We had the same number of people
okay.
In 2023. And then 2024, so far, I would say, you know, it has kind of felt like this, you know, continuous gradual decline in, you know, conditions in our world, which is, you know, with small tech companies in terms of the volume of hiring, right? I feel like where we really do best for a number of reasons is when there's lots of demand. Now, you know, who doesn't do best when there's lots of demand for their services, right? But so we have not seen that climb back up. And I watch this indicator on LinkedIn that you know, is basically the what they call the rate of hiring, but it's a LinkedIn employment report. Mm-hmm. You have to kind of like triple click in there to find this graph, and you can see this graph that to me is very, very relevant to us because it is LinkedIn making that assessment. So that's essentially saying the jobs that are most likely to be posted on LinkedIn, which is our world, right? So that's mm-hmm. a lot of tech jobs, a lot of sales jobs, not a lot of government jobs, mm-hmm. probably a whole lot less healthcare jobs, a whole lot less leisure and hospitality. So the three areas of biggest growth in the last year and a half for jobs for sure have been government, healthcare, leisure, and hospitality. None of those use LinkedIn to hire. So to me, that LinkedIn graph is telling the story of what we're experiencing. And it showed a really big drop off from second half of 2022 going down, and then a much more, you know, slight reduction since then over
okay.
the past 12 months.
Okay. So what's the size and structure of your team, Brock?
So we have five people in the US, five or six overseas.
Great. Okay. Overseas where?
So one in Argentina, one in Colombia, two in the Philippines, two in India, but the two in India are not really our employees. They're contracted through a firm.
Okay. All right. Interesting. So, and you guys do permanent direct hire placements. Is it retained? Is it contingency?
Some retained, mostly contingency.
Okay. And what's the, by the way, these are rapid fire questions because people always want to know when I'm in, and if I fail to ask these questions, because people are trying to figure out they want context for the conversation. What's your business model? Is it full desk? Is it split desks?
So three of us are full desk mm-hmm. and let's call it three and a half. There's a fourth in our office who's kind of becoming full desk now. Mm-hmm. She's getting clients of her own for the first time. So three and a half full desk mm-hmm. and then two and a half who are, you know, candidate side recruitment focused. Mm-hmm. And then that's not true. Everyone outside the US. Everyone else besides who I just described is all support related. And so that could be administrative support. That could be database related. They might actually send out messages, but they never get on the phone with candidates or clients or anything like that.
Got it. Makes sense. Okay. Fantastic. And then I know you're really, you mentioned you like modernizing and you're trying to stay on, you know, on top of that and stay competitive and evolve your practice. What's your tech stack look like?
Mm. So this is not where I feel like I shine,
okay.
but I, you know, try to, you know, again, hopefully I said the word try to stay, you know, in touch with kind of modern tools and so on. And so tech stack is, you know, I mean, we have a few people on the team, but not everyone has LinkedIn Recruiter.
Yeah.
That does feel valuable for those who don't have LinkedIn Sales Navigator. We use one of the many tools that's related to LinkedIn. Ours is called Prospect Ladder, but okay. there's a whole bunch of these that do similar work. And then we use Lusha to get contact information. We have Zoom Info, but we found it to be subpar, so we don't, you know, we're not going to be repurchasing Zoom Info.
Mm-hmm.
And so Bullhorn is our ATS. And I'm struggling to think of any additional
email,
tools that we use.
Email automation?
We don't have any email automation today.
Okay.
We have looked at it, and the biggest challenge is I personally feel like I would need to have a true ops person probably based in the US in order to utilize that. I'm not sure that any of us are ready to use that the way that it's meant to be used.
Okay.
When we're kind of battling with ourselves over time spent talking to actually candidates and clients versus, you know, interacting with an email automation tool.
Let's talk about that offline. I can definitely point you in the right direction with that.
Awesome.
And what about video? Like, do you guys send videos to clients and candidates, or?
It depends on what you mean by that. I'll tell you what we do, and then we can back up into whether or not I answered your question. So I have been now for 3 years creating a video. It's, you know, I post about one every 2 weeks, and they were all focused on candidate job seeker tips, tools, and a lot of don't do's, right? And that was a kind of the right direction in 2021 and 2022. In 2023, I'm not sure that was the right direction, but that's still what I was doing. Very recently, I've turned the corner to making my videos are predominantly about sales leaders and trying to help sales leaders win by getting the best talent they can get and do's and don't do's and tools and tips.
I love that. Fantastic. So Sanjay was on the podcast earlier, and we had a whole session about leveraging video to grow your recruitment business. So I'll send you the link once that's published. Awesome. What about using personalized videos for prospecting?
So what I'm doing right now, so I have attempted what you're describing, but not at scale, not at enough of a scale to say, I tried that and it didn't work. It'd be like, I dipped my toe, it didn't immediately work, and I backed out.
Okay.
And colleagues of mine on my team attempted and had the same result.
Okay.
All of us can only claim to have dipped our toes, and that's it.
So shout out to Julia Arpeg, who's we interviewed today. She was sitting where you're sitting. She's recruiting in tech, and she's doing really well right now for a variety of reasons, but one thing she shared on the podcast is she's going all in with her. She does automated prospecting, but she's also doing highly personalized video prospecting. But she is doing 20 a day, like 100 a week. That's the kind of like rhythm that she's doing to get a response and then turn that into a deal.
Can I ask a question real quick?
Yeah.
So is she making every single one of those custom? And by that, I mean like, she has to make it over and over again in order to say the person's name at the beginning. Holy moly.
Yeah.
So she's making 100 a week.
Yeah.
I'm impressed. I'm impressed. That's challenging.
So that's really good information. Thanks for sharing that, Brock. I want to finish with, you've built an awesome team. You've got folks in the States, you've got folks overseas, and but then sales go to 50%. How have you been navigating through that as a leader? Because that can be, that can be really disheartening, discouraging, and scary for everybody in the business. And you know, but they're looking to you for leadership. How have you approached that?
I think one of the things that I use that I'm not claiming is the right way or that it's even successful is, you know, empathy is not the right word. I guess making sure that everybody on the team knows that I'm in the same place as them. Mm-hmm. Hey, this is super challenging for all of us together at the same time. Let's see what we can try next to improve our at bats, or, you know, improve the percentage of the time that we're hitting or whatever it is. So, you know, one thing is that just being accessible and being honest about the difficulty as it is, and, you know, not saying that that's an excuse to not put in the effort, but it's kind of indirectly me giving them an excuse to what their numbers look like, right? Because mine look that way. So what am I going to be talking down to anyone about when, you know, I can see it in my own numbers? So, and then, you know, there is something I'm doing differently this time than in prior recessions. And I say than in prior recessions, because for us, this is a recession. I mean, this is, you know, doesn't really get—
It's not a technical recession, right? You've not had two quarters of contraction.
We did in 23. In 2023. Or I don't know if it was last two of 22 or the first two of 23. So
it
we
was,
had
no,
two
it was 20. It was, yeah, it was, I think, 22.
Yep. But everybody would say that that wasn't, you know, even though it was a technical recession, the, the two quarters of negative GDP growth, everybody would say we didn't feel like we were in a recession in the NA something, whatever the group is that that says, yes, we're in recession, did not say that because they said it wasn't broad-based and across, you know, enough industries. And so in, you know, the situation that we're in and similar situations in the past, I have generally just throttled back spending really fast and taken tools away from everybody immediately and said, we don't have the money. And so we're not going to have these things. And, you know, at least you still have your salary, right? And it just, it kind of created, you know, not only more difficulty for the people on the team, but I think it did create more of a negative environment, right? And so now one thing I'm trying really hard to do is keep myself in check when it comes to the desire to throttle back. If it's tools that are
revenue
generating and they're creating any kind of traction, I'm not inclined to pull them away. But any of the stuff that felt fluffy before, not doing that now.
Right. What falls under the fluffy category?
Oh, man, I you know what? I feel like that's like saying, like, remind me of a few of the most notable things that happened while you were in the Vietnam War. I've gone through like so many things that were a waste of money, but they were at a time where it was not so painful, but I was in each and every case, I thought this looks like it has promise. It's worth trying.
Experiment. That, absolutely.
And then I could look at them after the fact and go, okay, they did not produce anything.
Yeah.
Maybe someone could make the argument we didn't go at it long enough or we didn't, you know, put enough behind it or what have you. But, but I'll simply say I've gladly tucked those away. I've forgotten what those are.
Fair enough. Brock, I think what's good and what you can, your team can definitely relate to is you've been here before, right? And as you, as we said earlier, you're still here 25, 26 years in, and this is just a normal pattern, you know, that's, it's not gonna be the last time. You've been through this multiple times already, and we're gonna be, we're going to be okay, right? It's going to be okay. The demand will increase again. And you're sort of a role model for that.
Yeah. And that, to your point, and now I realize an answer I should have given to your prior question is like, I think of this as winter. Like winter happens as one of the four seasons, right? And right now we're in winter. The problem is we don't know if we're at January 1st or February 15th. Are we about to climb out of this? Or, you know, we still in the early days of this? That part is really hard to predict. The 2001 and 2002 recession for us felt like it lasted much longer. Ironically, comparatively to what other industries saw, the 2008 and 9 for us was quicker. And we saw a snapback much faster. Okay. You know, 2010 was probably, you know, one of my top 4 years just right after that happened. And so that one was shorter. And so what I am telling everybody, you know, there's you know, one guy I work with who's, we've been working together for 25 years. So I don't have to say it to him. He's been there in the trenches with me the whole time. But to everybody else, I'm saying, you know, look, we've had shorter ones. We've had longer ones. All I can tell you is it's like winter and spring will come. I just can't tell you exactly when. Right. And so, yeah, agreed with exactly what you just said.
Fantastic. Brock, I could talk to you all day. This has been super fun. Thank you so much for being on the show. Was there anything else you wanted to discuss today that we haven't covered?
No, I guess whatever comes to mind, I'll reach out to you and talk offline. And I am curious to watch some of the other ones and see how everybody's doing and, you know, and get into Pinnacle and see how everybody's doing and how everybody feels about the market right now.
Absolutely. I'll look forward to seeing you there tomorrow.
Awesome.
Thanks so much, Brock.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for watching. If you enjoyed this conversation, check out some of my other episodes. You'll see one or two suggested episodes on the screen now.